Hello, 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 and welcome to the My Empty Hands podcast. This is Reggie Darden, and today I have with me Sean Gordon, and we're just going to, you know, get right in and talk about some Kenpo and martial arts and whatever else we want to talk about today. So to just kind of give a little bit of my background, kind of go through my background a little bit. I started Kenpo in the early to mid 90s after seeing The Perfect Weapon. I instantly fell in love with Kenpo and got jumped right into that. Started training and trained at that original school for about 2 to 3 years. Got almost about halfway to my third brown. Then I left for the Army. While I was in the Army, I did a little bit of Taekwondo and some Hapkido and some boxing. Got out of the Army and kind of did my own thing for a little bit until I found my other core art, which is a capoeira, and been doing that for a lot of years now. But I still, kept my love for Kenpo, and a few years ago found a school that I'm currently at, and training in American Kenpo. The original kind of style that I was in was a Chinese Kenpo school, but basically the kind of Tracy's Kenpo curriculum. Mm-hmm. And now I'm under the kind of Ed Parker, American Kenpo curriculum, and just enjoying that. I am working back in the saddle and working towards my third brown at this time. And just enjoying that. I also have kind of recently started my instructor's training. So at some point, we'll probably get into talking about your thoughts and advice and whatnot. Mm-hmm. in regards to teaching. So we'll get into that in a little bit. But that's kind of the brief history of my journey. So I'd like to hear, how did Kenpo find you? How did you get started? And we'll take it from there.
Well, I started when I was 10 years old. It's 46 years ago. The year was 1978, as a few of my buddies from school decided to go try karate. We didn't know anything about karate Kenpo or any styles or anything, but went to the local studio here in Warren, Ohio. And we took like an introductory course, and it was like 5 lessons. It was like an introductory lesson. We, learned a couple kicks, punches, self-defenses. And then that was it. And then we had to decide if we were going to continue or not. Well, we didn't continue right then. And it took about 6 months later, I was sitting and I was like, there was something to that, And I was like, I wonder what happens if I keep going. So I went back. My friends didn't, but I continued my journey. It was lineage through J.T. Will, which was also the Tracy's system. So I come up kind of like you did in the Tracy's lineage. And I got my black belt when I was 18 years old. and then I continued on. The studio I trained at had closed, so I really had nowhere to go. So I started searching around for other gyms in the area. And I met a gentleman named Joe Doyle, and I went to his gym. And it was about an hour's drive from here, so I had to do a lot of traveling. And the first thing he asked me, he goes, well, do you know the American version or the Tracy's version? I'm like, what do you mean? Didn't know. like I said, I thought Kenpo exactly. was Kenpo. He asked me, he goes, well, do long one. So I did long one. I did the first few moves. He goes, oh, you're the Tracy's version. I was like, how do you know that? And he showed me the small differences. And I was like, I was hooked. I'm like, okay. So I started training the Parker version. He took me up all the way pretty much through the system, reviewing everything. A lot of things were similar. Some things were different. So it kind of went hand in hand because Tracy's was an offshoot of the Parker version. So I trained with him a long time. The issue was it started to get to be a hassle with traveling and work and everything. Well, I found another studio closer to me in Youngstown. And I joined it. And they did Kempo, but what I discovered was they did somewhat of a mixture of Tracy's and American. Okay, so I was kind of like, all right. But I stayed there. I ended up teaching there. I got up to my fifth degree black belt there, and I was still training. And then the time come, I decided to open my own gym. What had happened was I had a friend of mine who I ended up fighting quite a bit at the tournaments. You know, we kind of come through the ranks together and everything. And he said to me one day, he says, well, why are we always fighting each other? He said, why don't we team up and make better studio for people? I said, let's do this. And so we did. So Mark Feeks and I joined up, and, you know, we created our own studio and stuff. And we were meshing his Taekwondo with Kempo. But he did more of an American kickboxing type, not strict Taekwondo. Well, then his work took him away, and then I ended up by myself. So I just started teaching strict Kempo. And I worked my way up, and I joined up with a Grandmaster Paul Lukuski. And he has since passed away a few years ago. I miss the gentleman a lot because he showed me a lot that I didn't know. And it was very funny how he tested me to see who I was. The first seminar he ever did at our school, he worked with all the black belts, but he told me to take this book he had written, and he wanted me to proofread it. And I was like, yes, sir. So I sat there proofreading this book. And when we were done, he asked me what I thought of it. And I said, well, I said, this one kata in there that you have written out, I said, from reading it, sounds like a lot like short three. And he looked at me and goes, oh, you are a Kempo person. So basically he was testing me to see if I really knew Kempo. And I was like, okay. And he started training me. And I got up to my seventh degree under him. And he fell into a coma. And I went down and took care of him for 2 weeks. He was passing. And I closed the school for him and did a lot of the stuff. His wife was from Thailand, so I had to help take a lot of the customs in America that she didn't know about, the funeral and everything. Well, there was me, Mark Feeks, Rick McCollister, and his daughter. We had a meeting, and the discussion was who was going to take over the schools. And I sat back and I said, listen, guys, I said, I don't care who you guys choose. I said, I don't want to be in that. I said, you guys decide who you want. 10 minutes later, they come out and they're like, well, Mr. Gordon, you're it. We're come to the consensus as a panel. We're going to give you the promotion up to his level, which was 10th degree. I was getting ready to test for my 8th under. I was supposed to test in like 3 weeks before he had his coma incident. So, and I was like, okay, I was honored by that. And that's how I got to my 10th degree. So it was an honor thing that I got moved up. So that's, in a nutshell, basically my Kempo career.
Okay. Going back to that school that you trained at, where they were mixing the two versions, do you happen mm-hmm. to kind of find out what the reasoning behind that was? I'm kind of curious.
I think a lot of the reasoning was, it was a tournament oriented school, so they were adopting things to use at the tournament competition level. I trained with a gentleman named Chuck Masters there, who taught me all the American version of the Kempo forms. So that's how I got those. He was also on his own teaching too. But the self-defense is what I mainly noticed that they had changed. And I made them more of a mixture towards the competition level. So they look better, but they were easier for the kids to do and stuff like that. And I believe that's where the blend came in. So,
So you've always kind of do you have a preference for a particular version, or?
I really like the Parker version. I like the detail. I like how they concentrate on the concepts and theories and principles. Oh, I noticed the Tracy's didn't do a lot of that. They just, when I came up, they did more of they show you and you do it. You know, they didn't really explain why my body moves this way, moves that way. And I'm really getting into that now that I'm with Master Kelly. He's like a college professor in the art, you know, and he's really getting me down to those details. So that's why I prefer the Parker version. I just like the science behind it.
Gotcha. Yeah, I was kind of in a similar boat when I, started at my current school, in that, I truly loved my original school, and I still do, and my original instructor. But yeah, we didn't kind of get into the weeds, so to speak, at my first school, in that, we didn't do freestyle. We didn't, do terminologies and the principles. And correct. So I didn't feel like I got the, or I should say once I got involved in my current school, I started getting a deeper understanding of the why and not just the how. Mm-hmm. And having applying those principles and things like that just really gave me a greater sense and a greater enjoyment for the art as well.
Same here.
A little bit more thinking and a little less memorizing. So I always have kind of a laugh mm-hmm. with some of my cohorts in that it's like, so our school, we're on the 16 technique curriculum. And there's so much stuff that we got to learn. And it's like, well, my first school, we did 40 techniques per belt. So 16 isn't too bad. But
a lot easier. I don't
know, maybe it kind of evens out. It evens out because, since we didn't do the test, we didn't do freestyle, we didn't do terminology. So maybe it kind of evened out, probably a little less basics. So yeah, I think it probably kind of evened out a little bit. But learning 16 techniques is a lot easier than 40 each belt. So
yes, so it is. But what I've discovered, though, is that at the 16 technique level, we get so in-depth into them. I mean, it's amazing how much detail there is in each technique, applying the principles and stuff. At 40 techniques, if we did that, it'd take forever to get through belt level because there's so much to do. And it's amazing. But once you learn the concepts and principles, you can apply them to the older techniques as you go through the belts because you know what you're supposed to be doing body-wise, and you start to discover. So it all links together eventually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like being able to, to break down the techniques more, with mm-hmm. having less that you're getting at a time. Yeah, you can get more in-depth with each technique. At our school, as of recently, we've, been doing a lot with, okay, we'll just take delayed sword and we're just, breaking down delayed sword mm-hmm. and inserting and altering and modifying and doing all of these different things with just this one technique. And, we can spend half the class just working on delayed sword, and then the other half, okay, now we got alternating maces and we're just breaking that mm-hmm. down and working that. And it's like, it's interesting that you can mine so much with, what on the outside looks like, looks like not much. It's like, oh, well, it's just the first two techniques. Like, okay, we can get through that in 5 minutes.
Right.
Like, no, we can spend hours just breaking that down. So,
I just came back from Florida last weekend. I trained with Master Kelly and we were doing some seminars there, and he took Dance of Death. And he did it not just from the punch, he did it from a kick, he did it from various different attacks. And it was amazing how you could take that one self-defense and use the moves out of it for different attacks, but it's still the same self-defense. Maybe a little bit of a different entry on, like how we trapped the leg and stuff, but it all ended up being Dance of Death, So it's amazing how you can adapt things. And like you're saying, even the base techniques, delayed sword, okay, yeah, it's for a grab, okay? You do a dead hand attack because you got a beginner-level student. They're not used to seeing a punch come at them. So you do a dead-handed attack. Well, if you think about it and examine it, you could actually do it off of a punch or anything in that version. It's just you're learning the principles and concepts at the beginning, and then you just apply them later to the advanced stuff.
Exactly. So, going over, you kind of mentioned about competing. Did you do a lot of competing mm-hmm. as you were coming up?
Yes, I did. I started competing when I was in my lower ranks back in the early 80s. My first tournament, I was only an orange belt, and I walked in there, and it was very amazing because they said I was too big to be in the kids division, and I ended up fighting adults. Now, I'm only like 13 years old, you know, and I'm in the adult division, novice. So I didn't know what to do. My dad was there. He's an ex-Marine, so he was kind of coaching me off to the side. And I fought all the way up to the first and second place match. And I'm all pumped up as a kid, like, man, I'm beating adults. I'm doing great. And then they called out the gentleman I had to fight, and this guy was, like, way taller than me. And I just looked at him, and I looked at my dad and for, like, a coach, and my dad said, you're done. This guy was so nice, though. He had to reach. You know, he didn't try to hurt me. But then I just started competing continuously after that, all the way up through my black belt. I ended up being the 13-time state champion in Ohio. Breaking was my big thing. I loved to do the breaking. And I did the fighting also. The only thing I didn't do was a lot of was katas. I wasn't a big kata competitor. Mine was more to fighting and breaking. So from the early 90s up through the 2000s, you know, I did a lot of competing. 1990, I went to Long Beach Internationals with Mr. Doyle. We had a blast. That was the one time I got to meet Master Parker, which was amazing. Very humble guy, very open, you know, took me off to the side, worked with me for some time on stuff. And he didn't even know me. I just got introduced to him by Mr. Doyle. And then he goes, oh, you're switching from the Tracy's to the American? Boom, off he went. Started showing me some differences, you know. Great guy. I wish I'd have got to know him even better, but he passed away a few months after that. So competition was good. It pushes you, and it, like I said, though, it's a sport. It's not the combatives part of Kempo. It's the sports side of it. But it does help you with your timing and stuff like that. And I can't say anything about it, about my tournament career. I've enjoyed it a lot. I'm retired now. I retired in 2012 was my last competition. Until this year, the Nationals, the PKC Nationals here, decided they were going to bring breaking back. And I was like, oh, man. I said, can I do this one more time? And my wife was totally, you know, listen. She says, you got to quit doing this because I actually do breaks with my head and stuff, you know, bricks and stuff like that.
Oh.
And I told her, I said, you know what? Let me do this one more time. Let me see if I still got it, you know. And I went in and I ended up winning. I won the national title for 2024. And now I'm officially retired. So I just had to push myself one more time. But the great thing about that was some of the kids at my gym is I don't push competition. You know, if they want to compete, they can. And they never have. Well, then they saw I was going. They're like, oh, Mr. Gordon, take us with you. So I took a few of them with me, and a few of them won national titles that day. So I was very proud of them, and I was glad I was able to inspire them to move on and try. And that's my job now, is to coach these kids and make them better than what they are and get them to that level. And I believe quite a few of them will. So that's my competition career. But I enjoyed it.
Oh, very nice. Yeah, I had... maybe it would be probably a stretch to say I had a handful of tournaments. I went to a lot as a spectator.
That's fine.
But I only competed in, you know, probably less, I'm sure less than five ones, and it was just in sparring, and I kept getting disqualified because it was always, you know, oh, well, you know, you're not allowed to do the back fist to the head or something like that. And I would keep forgetting that.
Oh, wow.
I'm not supposed to do that. And so, yeah, I would get disqualified a lot. I didn't ever get to compete in forms, mainly because all the kind of favorite forms that I wanted to do, I didn't learn those at the time. So all my competing was kind of earlier on in my training, but, I wanted to be able to do book set in a tournament, and
yeah.
Hadn't learned it yet, so I was like, oh well, shoot, I can't. I want to get into that.
That's a Tracy's kata.
yep. Yeah.
Because now, I can tell you this.
I kind of. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, the Tracy's Cotta's, you know, they did Booksett and Tiger and a Crane, which I'm sure you're familiar with, but the American Parker version doesn't use those. And Tiger and a Crane was always one of my forms that, I shouldn't say I hated it, I always had trouble with it, you know. It was so long and all the twisting and stuff, you know. And I'll never forget when I joined up with Mr. Doyle and he says, oh, no, we don't do Tiger and a Crane. I was like, yes, thank you. It's like, I don't have to do that kind of again. But I still remember Booksett. Booksett was always one of my favorites, and I still know it to this day. I just, there's a couple of them that I just kept fooling around with and kept them in there. So, yeah, it's amazing how you learn different things, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I had kind of a different or an opposite experience to that. So when I started at my current school, I was a little bummed at first because it's like, okay, well, you know, yeah, you did Kenpo, but it was a different Kenpo. So, you know, you got to start over at white again. And I was, you know, like, okay, well, you know, I guess I'll do that. But, you know, I want to hurry up and get to my green so I can get back to doing book set again. And my instructor was like, oh, yeah. And you're like, we don't do book set here. I was like, oh, wait, what? I'm like, that's all I wanted, you know, I want to do. But I got in touch with my original instructor and got some training videos to refresh my memory. I'm back to, I run through book set at least a couple of times a week now. So I have fun with that. But I still toy with the idea of possibly going into a, you know, I toy around with you know, going to a tournament and doing a form. I'm not really sure if I will or not, but I kind of want to do it to at least, you know, say, okay, well, I've at least competed once in forms or
there you go.
But I don't know. We'll see. And then, you know, getting back into the sparring. Not sure if my wife wants me to. Well, I already know she doesn't want me to spar. So we'll see if that if that ever materializes. But I did enjoy, you know, going to the tournaments and then, you know, watching and cheering on my buddies and all of that.
There you go.
I have kind of a vague memory of going to internationals. This would have probably been around 94, 95.
Okay.
Maybe even 90, 96. But I'm pretty sure that it was at internationals, but this big, huge fight broke out. There was... kind of the whole day, everybody was kind of complaining about the judging and whatnot. I just remember this big brawl just kind of going crazy. And, you know, instead of sticking around and testing our skills, we packed up and got out of there before we got into the mix. But yeah, I remember that was just really a kind of an insane time, you know, so excited, first time being at a really big tournament, and it's like, oh, well, we weren't there for very long, and it's like, okay, now it's time to go.
That's the sad part, because people should know better than to do something like that. You're putting a black eye on the competition and the sport itself. I mean, yes, the judging might have been something wrong or something, but sometimes you just got to roll with that and let it go and just keep performing and do what you do, you know. And that's how you learn. I'd have to say those people that got in a fight might not have been the best people to be there. I mean, that's not a good representation, because you got to look at it this way. There's probably a lot of new people at each tournament that are trying a tournament for the first time, and they see something like that happen, and they're never going to go back. So they're going to lose a part of what martial arts is, you know. It puts a black eye on it. So, yeah, I've been throughout my career, that's one thing I've promoted was the respect and sportsmanship with my kids. Like, if you don't get the point called or you don't agree with the judge's scoring, bow, shake hands, do whatever you got to do. You know, talk to me outside the ring, you know, but don't get a bad attitude in the ring and show disrespect. And that's one of my biggest, you know, fulcrums of what I do in the martial arts is total sportsmanship. So,
So going back to the breaking real quick, what was your favorite break and what was your hardest break?
Well, when I started out breaking, I was a teenager, and we broke wood, all right? And my one instructor, when I was first coming up, would break boards with his head, and he would headbutt them. So I was like, you know, I said, this is kind of cool. I said, I'm going to try that, and I broke one with my forehead. Well, as the years progressed, I got more into what was called the extreme breaking, where, you know, I had to go above and beyond what the other black belts were going to do. And I got totally away from using any wood. I break all bricks now. And I started to where I was headbutting through five bricks, you know. And people were like, dude, that's going to give you brain damage. And I'm like, no, I've conditioned for it. So that's one of the hardest breaks I do, is breaking the bricks with my forehead. And then that progressed to where I've gotten even other stuff. I break baseball bats with my shins. I do two with one leg, three with the other leg, okay? But then my final trick was, it drove my wife nuts, was I will kneel down and put a stack of like four or five bricks on top of my head, and one of my students will climb up on a ladder and drop a bowling ball and shatter them off the top of my head. And that's when she said, no, 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 you're done. She goes, you're not going any further. So I did that a few times, and I kept my championship, and I did it this one last time in 2024 to bring back the championship home. And I had to promise her that was it, you know, because she's worried that I'm going to hurt myself. And I can say this, Master Kelly talked to me about it. I had a lot of people talk to me like, listen, do you understand what you're doing to your brain? And I'm like, yes, I do. I said, but it was kind of weird because I was the man that did that, you know. So I had to do it one last time and see what I could do. So, yeah, I mean, that's my hardest break, is I break bricks with my head. And it's, you know, it's an amazing thing, but I got to stop sometime.
Yeah, I think. There's probably a limited count on how many times you can do that in a lifetime. That's safe. Mm-hmm. So that's good. So looking at going to the teaching aspect, can you go ahead and talk about first, you know, the early days of when you got into the teaching side? One, was that always something that you were interested in, or did it kind of the desire to teach, did that come later? Or
it kind of fell into place. Where I was learning at, once you got to a certain rank, we become an assistant in classes, and then once you got profound at that, then they would have you run a class, you know. But the instructor was always there watching you to make sure you're doing things right. And that's how I got into teaching. I never thought of being a teacher at first, but it kind of got put into it. And from there, it just snowballed. And I just, you know, I love teaching and I love showing stuff. And I think part of that is it keeps me level-headed of where I'm at, because I'm working with a young kid or a young adult and I'm seeing them make mistakes and I'm correcting them. But in my head, I'm thinking, did I do those same mistakes when I was at that rank? So it reminds me of where I came from, you know, because I'm sure I did all those same mistakes. And I tell them that, like, listen, oh, you're off balance on this roundhouse kick. It's okay. Turn your foot, turn your hips over, give them some pointers on how to keep their balance. And I'm thinking back, yeah, I probably did all that. And I know I did. And that's why I love teaching now, because I'm making them a better person. Along with my teaching, as I try to be a mentor to my students, you know, if they have an issue at home or at school or anything like that, they know they can come talk to me and I'll help them through it the best I can. You know, so I'm not just a martial arts instructor. I also help my kids through life issues, you know. And I can say over the years, I've helped a lot of kids with that. And that's why I love teaching, because I want them to be the next one. I just had a conversation with a gentleman today who called me out of the blue, part of the CKF family. And we were talking about that. He says, you know, you're a little bit younger than us. He says, but we're going to be gone someday. And he actually said this to me. He goes, you're going to be one of the bearers of the torch. And I said, well, I hope I can be. I said, that's what I'm striving for. But now I look forward beyond that. Who's going to carry it after, say, something happens to me? If I become that person, if I become one of the torchbearers and I do all this and then I pass away, who takes over from where I'm at? So that's what I'm trying to develop in these kids that I'm working with so they can become what I am. I look at it that way. If they can succeed, then I've done my job.
Excellent. So can you talk a little bit about the early days of your teaching, maybe things that maybe you would have done different in contrast to, you know, how you teach now, and mm-hmm. you know, just kind of looking at it from the aspect of, so, you know, I'm in my early days of teaching Kenpo. I, you know, kind of taught, okay. I taught capoeira for a lot of years. But on the Kenpo side of it, just looking for, you know, kind of your advice that you would, you know, you would give to instructors that are getting kind of started out, and looking at your previous, you know, when you started out, kind of avoiding the pitfalls, okay. and different things, or just perspective that you have now.
Okay, a few things I can say on that. When I grew up and I came through the ranks, the school I attended was more of a militaristic type school. I mean, it was smash mouth Kenpo. You fought every day. You made contact. It was a rough sport back when I was coming up through the early 80s. The thing was, I found out through the years, because I did kickboxing, I've done MMA. If you don't train properly, you can get lifelong injuries that are going to stick with you, where training now has advanced where there's ways to kind of avoid some of that and make yourself healthier. I wish I'd have known about all that when I was a teenager, because like I said, back in the day, I did a lot of crazy things, you know, breaking and stuff. And I have some injuries now that once in a while flare up and I'm like, oh man, I shouldn't have done that. You know? Also for a new instructor, I try to tell them, keep a couple things in mind. First of all, don't have an ego, you know, that you're now a black belt and you're instructing, or whatever level you're instructing at, because that's not how you should have been taught if you were taught that way, all right? We're here to mentor these kids and teach them the right way. So that's the main thing for a new instructor, is to be level-headed and calm, cool, and collected with the kids. Become their friends. Be a place where they can feel comfortable and safe around you, so they know they have somewhere to go, because this world isn't getting any better. I mean, there's a lot of problems out in this world that these kids are dealing with, and you might be the only person they feel trusted to talk to. And the other thing with instructing is take your time, okay? I will say this, I learned more by teaching than I ever learned by my lessons that I was taught, because I start to, like I said, I see them throwing a kick the wrong way or a technique the wrong way, and I'm like, all right, well, this is how you do it, and they're still not getting it right. Well, now I've got to figure out a way to show them how to do it properly that they understand it, because everybody learns differently, all right? What I might use is my verbiage from back when I was taught might not work for them. They might not understand it, so I got to find a way to tweak it where they understand it, and that becomes a challenge. So you need to be level-headed, calm, cool, collected, and just work with these kids. And be proud of what you do, okay? Because not everybody can do it. It's a very hard thing to do to become an instructor. You have to be confident. You got to be on top of it. And don't be afraid to speak. And use that as your basis.
Gotcha. I like it. So since you've, you know, been teaching and been involved in the art for a lot of years now, what is kind of your view in regards to maybe the attitudes of the students now with the, you know, the advent of the UFC and, you know, MMA and all of that? You've seen kind of a change in maybe the attitudes or the I don't know, demeanor, you know, I see that the UFC kind of breeds a lot of these, you know, very, you know, cocky, entitled, kind of this, I would say maybe less desirable attitudes towards, you know, the martial arts. And, you know, so kind of, have you seen that change, you know, when you get new students in and they're, you know, wanting to be, you know, whatever, MMA guy. And it's like, how do you maybe kind of steer them back towards, you know, the Mr. Miyagi days of you know, how people view the martial arts. Like, so I'm just kind of curious as to your kind of thoughts or perspective or views in how the attitude and the mindset has changed towards the martial arts in general.
Okay. Well, most of the kids I get in now are coming in. You get those ones that come in and I want to learn how to fight. Well, you need to show them there's a whole other side. It's not just fighting. And sometimes that just takes time to let them see it. You know, it's kind of a self-discovery. You know, you show them other things and they're like, what is this? You explain it to them and it kind of veers them in a different direction. MMA has given it a cockier attitude over the years. Now, I will say this. I'm not blasting all MMA people. There are some very respectful MMA people out there, okay? I've met a few of them, and I've actually got a chance to meet Hoist Gracie. And, of course, you know, he was the first guy in the UFC to win it 3 years in a row. He was the big name, you know? And you're looking at somebody, you're like, oh, my God, this guy could hurt me. When I met him, he was so humble and so nice. He didn't portray that attitude that, you know, he could beat you up or fight you and destroy you. He had none of that. None of that. I've met many martial artists over the years, famous martial artists, and I would say 99.9% of them had no ego. You know, I've met people that I know that could take me in a ring and beat me, okay, because they're at that level. They're at that high of a level of the game. But they didn't have that ego. So I'm not blasting all MMA fighters. I've trained MMA fighters for fighting a cage. The biggest thing that I did was anybody to come in and wanted to do MMA, you know, like, oh, I want to fight in 3 months. I'm like, well, let me tell you what we're going to do. You're going to train with me for at least 1 year. I said, and then when 1 year is up, I'm going to evaluate you and see where you're at. In a year, if you've got a lot of stuff down, good basics, good body mechanics, and you're, you know, fit and stuff, I said, maybe I'll get you a fight. You know, I'll get you into one. If I didn't think they were ready, I'd tell them, no, you're not ready. You need to train more. So I kept them tempered that way. But I will say this, my MMA guys, I taught them the same thing. Win or lose, you shake that guy's hand. You know, no disrespect. And I never had a problem with that with my guys. They were always respectful, mm-hmm. Win or lose. Martial arts wise, like I said, a lot of these kids coming in now are coming in because they're having problems at school. They're getting bullied at school. They have issues for broken families or whatever, you know, single parent household. So maybe dad's not in the picture. This kid's coming in and you're going to fill some of that male role model for him. Okay. And that becomes hard because mom is, you know, having a hard time with the child because, you know, she's on her own. You're going to pick up some of that slack for them. And that's why I say I talk to my kids and whatever they need, I will help them as best I can. So, yeah, that's how I teach the respect part of it and not let them have that ego. And it's a very fine-edged sword sometimes, okay? You got to read the child, see what they need, adapt the program to that specific kid. You can't teach every kid the same. Because every kid's coming in with a different skill set or a different mindset. So that's how I approach my teaching. I'm there to help the children. That's my goal. I'm not there to teach them how to fight, you know. In the end game, they will learn how to fight. You know, if something happens that they have to fight, they will know how to fight. But I teach them the whole gamut of everything in the martial arts. All the way from meditative practices, everything, breathing, proper technique, everything I can. I don't hold anything back for my kids. I teach them.
Gotcha. I like it. I like it. So what are your views on just like where do you see the future of Kenpo, or where would you like to see it going? Maybe are you seeing kind of any trends of things that maybe you don't want to, you know, continue on, or are there things that, you know, maybe you're starting to see a little bit of the seeds of that you would like to, you know, grow into more things?
What I see in a Kenpo community,
you know, where do you see the future, or where would you like to see the future go?
Yeah. In the Kenpo community, what I've noticed, there's too many professors now that feel they're the... When Master Parker died, they all thought I was the man to take over. Well, he never named someone to take over. As those higher ranks, it's another one where we've got to set our egos aside and come together as a group and promote the art. The art is always going to evolve. Master Parker was evolving the art up until the day he died. So things are going to change, okay? But I think it needs to be by a group method that we change things and evolve it. Too many of these people are out there like, oh, this is the way it was done, and then this guy was, you know, this is the way I did. Master Parker taught each person differently also, because he would say this, that your body mechanics are never the same. My sidekick, I might have to throw it a little bit different than somebody else's sidekick. Does that mean mine is wrong? No. I took the concept, principles, and theories of Kenpo, and I adapted them to my body style on how I would fight or how I would throw a technique. Doesn't mean that I'm doing it wrong. It's mean I took the system and made it my style. That's exactly what Kenpo is. Kenpo is a system. What you make out of it is your style, because it's all based on principles. As long as you apply those and you can explain them, why you're doing something, you're doing Kenpo, okay? But yeah, we have to set aside the egos in the community. And I've ran into some of those people like, well, I'm the head honcho. No, you're not. No one is. We are a family, and that's what we need to be. Come together and work together and make it whole again. It happened to Jeet Kune Do. There's many instructors out there that they feel they were Bruce Lee's protege. Same as in Kenpo. I believe this happens in every system too. When the grandmaster passes away, everybody feels they're entitled to being the next one. And that's not true, because they did not say you were the next one. If they said, yeah, you're it, you're it. Nobody really did that though. So yeah, I think we need to put all those egos aside and come together and work together and make the art better, because that will show a unity. And I think that would attract more people to the art, because people come into the art and then they start hearing like, oh, I learned Kenpo from this guy and that's the way it should be. Oh, well, he's doing it wrong. That guy doesn't know what he's talking about. There's this sad dissension, and it's not respectful. I think we need to all respect each other and work together. That's my opinion on where I think the art should go. I would love to see that happen, but I don't think it ever will because of those egos. One of the first things I said to Master Kelly, the first time I went down to his Zen of Kenpo camp, we had a conversation on the phone. I'd never been down there. That's how I met him, was over the internet. Started talking to him on the phone. He invited me down. Now, I wear a 10th degree black belt, and I told him, I said, listen, I'm coming to your camp. I'm a white belt. I said, I'm coming down there to learn everything I can. I said, I'm not coming there. I'm a nobody. That's what I tell everybody. I'm a nobody. I've learned many things, but I'm not the supreme.
All right. So we'll see if if I edit this part out. But just making note that we had a little technical difficulty within the recording. So
yep.
if there's a little inconsistency with the episode there, that's what's going on. But we're just kind of actually getting to our lightning round or our closing questions anyway. So, yeah, we'll just kind of jump into that.
No problem.
I usually wrap up these episodes with some kind of fun little questions here.
Okay.
So the first one being, do you have a favorite technique?
Favorite technique out of all of them? I really like Grip of Death for the headlock. It's one of my favorites.
Oh, yes. That's a good one. Very good. Very good. Very good one. I like it. Okay. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
Competition-wise, I always did long two. I love long two for some reason. That was my go-to kata.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one. That's a good one. Always been, you know, me, I'm always been partial to Bookset and Tiger and Crane, but mm-hmm. I think a lot of people say that too. I also remember really liking long three, although I haven't done it in gosh over 20 plus years, but in my current training. Actually, that is the form for this belt. You know, I'm currently a green belt, so for my third brown, I gotta learn long three again. So, I'm interested to see if I still like it or not. I know that there's a particular move in the form that technique in the form that I really like, although the name of it is escaping my mind. I want to say it's something like Crouching Falcons or something like that, but
okay.
I can't remember it at the time, but yeah, it's a technique where you kind of give them kind of a double eye rake, and then you kind of come down and give them a double shot to the ribs, and then kind of come back up and you're flicking the eyes and
I know the spot you're talking about. And,
I love that. I don't know. I just love that movement or that technique. Maybe I guess it's kind of this way with all of Kenpo, or where it's like, you know, it's a lot of overkill, but
right. It's but you find so your spot.
So much fun to do. So yeah, exactly. Then the next question there is, do you have, or excuse me, if there was anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would that be?
It'd be Ed Parker Sr. There's no other else that I'd love to be able to train with.
Yeah, no, I agree. He was so ahead of his time that it's just, you know, it's really just amazing that, you know, someone could kind of come along and you know, not only have all of these kind of different ideas, you know, not just of his own, but be able to, you know, cultivate that from you know, different people that he worked with, and to also, you know, be able to kind of see the writing on the wall as far as, you know, where things were going, where things, you know, were evolving, yep. And seeing how, you know, oh, well, you know, these things, you know, that, you know, have been passed down for years and years and years in the arts, like, okay, maybe we don't need to keep all of these pieces around, or we need to modify these pieces, you know, times are changing, and
he did that a lot.
We need to change with the times, so that's huge. So actually, kind of, I don't usually throw this one in there, but I will put that in there. Do you have maybe like a favorite weapon or
I also hold a third degree black belt in Eshin Ryuto, and it's a samurai sword. I love that weapon. The katana has always been a match for me. I don't know why, but it's just one I love.
And in that, you know, actually, maybe can you maybe talk a little bit about that system? Not super familiar with it, you know. Maybe just kind of some of your observations about it in kind of comparison or contrast to Kenpo. And
okay. Yeah, Enchin Ryuedo is an art of drawing the sword. It has multiple katas in it. Now, their katas aren't like a long kata. It's just a certain draw and put away with certain steps to it. The thing I found interesting about it and how it compares somewhat to Kenpo is it's so strict on how your footwork is, where your hands are placed. Everything's there for a reason, and it you just got to break down the mechanics. And ever since I started to learn it from my last teacher, I just got hooked on it, and I just kept doing it and doing it. It's actually like a meditative practice to me to do it, because I block everything else out, and I just do those katas, and I'm concentrated so much on that kata and on the little intricacies, I'm not even thinking about anything else. So that's why I love it. It's very principle-oriented.
And in it, you know, so it's all about, you know, the drawing of the sword. There isn't, is there, you know, like sparring or you know.
There is no sparring in it unless you get part of it. The kendo aspect, yeah. With the shinais, the wooden swords. But we do a little bit of that, not a whole lot. It's more on the art of drawing.
Gotcha. I'm definitely gonna have to look more into that. That's, you think of the swords and you kind of, you know, think of the sword fighting or, you know, kind of Crouching Tiger, you know, samurai, you know, ninja movie things. And it's interesting to see art that's just, you know, kind of devoted to one aspect of that and right. Not necessarily kind of the fighting aspect of it. But, so, yeah, I'm definitely going to have to look into that. All right. So now would be your point for shameless, selfless promotion. So that would be the time where you can plug anything that you want or bring up anything that maybe we didn't touch on that you'd like to get out there. And now's your time to kind of say whatever you'd like.
What I'd like to say is to all the Kenpo practitioners is to set aside any differences that people have between instructors and try to come back together as a family and working together, because that's, I believe, what Master Parker wanted. I don't think he wanted this type of division. And feel free to ever contact me. I'm in Warren, Ohio. It's a great art. I'd love to spread it, keep teaching it. And that's basically it. I want everybody to come together and work as a team.
Excellent. Excellent. I love it. So yeah, thank you so much for being on and chatting with me. And I look forward to getting this out and having everyone else hear it. And let's keep on growing and training and learning and connecting. And I will be in touch when this is ready to go out. And
thank you, sir. As soon as we're done, I'll get this uploaded.
All right. Well, thank you. And we'll talk again.
All righty. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.